The third book of the Dialogues of Lucius Annaeus Seneca, Address to Novatus. Of Anger, Book 1. 1. You have demanded of me, Novatus, that I should write how anger may be soothed, and it appears to me that you are right in feeling a special fear of this passion, which is, above all others, hideous and wild. For the others have some alloy of peace and quiet, but this consists wholly in action and the impulse of grief, raging with an utterly inhuman lust for arms, blood, and tortures, careless of itself provided it hurts another, rushing upon the very point of the sword, and greedy for revenge, even when it drags the avenger to ruin with itself. Some of the wisest men have, in consequence of this, called anger a short madness, for it is equally devoid of self-control, regardless of decorum, forgetful of kinship, obstinately engrossed in whatever it begins to do, deaf to reason and advice, excited by trifling causes, awkward at perceiving what is true and just, and very like a falling rock which breaks itself into pieces upon the very thing which it crushes. That you may know that they whom anger possesses are not sane, look at their appearance. For as there are distinct symptoms which mark madmen, such as a bold and menacing air, a gloomy brow, a stern face, a hurried walk, restless hands, changed colour, quick and strongly drawn breathing, the signs of angry men, too, are the same. Their eyes blaze and sparkle, their whole face is a deep red, with the blood which boils up from the bottom of their heart. Their lips quiver, their teeth are set, their hair bristles and stands on end. Their breath is laboured and hissing, their joints crack as they twist them about. They groan, bellow, and burst into scarcely intelligible talk. They often clap their hands together and stamp on the ground with their feet, and their whole body is highly strung and plays those tricks which mark a distraught mind, so as to furnish an ugly and shocking picture of self-perversion and excitement. You cannot tell whether this vice is more execrable or more disgusting. Other vices can be concealed and cherished in secret. Anger shows itself openly and appears in the countenance, and the greater it is, the more plainly it boils forth. Do you not see how in all animals certain signs appear before they proceed to mischief, and how their entire bodies put off their usual quiet appearance and stir up their ferocity? Boars foam at the mouth and sharpen their teeth by rubbing them against trees. Bulls toss their horns in the air and scatter the sand with blows of their feet. Lions growl, the necks of enraged snakes swell. Mad dogs have a sullen look. There is no animal so hateful and venomous by nature that it does not, when seized by anger, show additional fierceness. I know well that the other passions can hardly be concealed, and that lust, fear, and boldness give signs of their presence and may be discovered beforehand, for there is no one of the stronger passions that does not affect the countenance. What, then, is the difference between them and anger? Why, that the other passions are visible, but that this is conspicuous. 2. Next, if you choose to view its results and the mischief that it does, no plague has cost the human race more dear. You will see slaughterings and poisonings, accusations and counter-accusations, sacking of cities, ruin of whole peoples, the persons of princes sold into slavery by auction, torches applied to roofs, and fires not merely confined within city walls, but making whole tracts of country glow with hostile flame. See the foundations of the most celebrated cities, hardly now to be discerned. They were ruined by anger. See deserts extending for many miles without an inhabitant. They have been desolated by anger. See all the chiefs whom tradition mentions as instances of ill fate. Anger stabbed one of them in his bed, struck down another, though he was protected by the sacred rites of hospitality, tore another to pieces in the very home of the laws, and in sight of the crowded forum, bade one shed his own blood by the parricide hand of his son, another to have his royal throat cut by the hand of a slave, another to stretch out his limbs on the cross. And hitherto I am speaking merely of individual cases. What if you were to pass from the consideration of those single men against whom anger has broken out, to view whole assemblies cut down by the sword, the people butchered by the soldiery let loose upon it, and whole nations condemned to death in one common ruin, as though by men who either freed themselves from our charge or despised our authority? Why, wherefore is the people angry with gladiators, and so unjust as to think itself wronged if they do not die cheerfully? It thinks itself scorned, and by looks, gestures, and excitement, turns itself from a mere spectator into an adversary. Everything of this sort is not anger, but the semblance of anger, like that of boys who want to beat the ground when they have fallen upon it, and who often do not even know why they are angry, but are merely angry without any reason or having received any injury, yet not without some semblance of injury received, or without some wish to exact a penalty for it. Thus they are deceived by the likeness of blows, and are appeased by the pretended tears of those who deprecate their wrath, and thus an unreal grief is healed by an unreal revenge. 3. We often are angry, says our adversary, not with men who have hurt us, but with men who are going to hurt us. So you may be sure that anger is not born of injury. It is true that we are angry with those who are going to hurt us, but they do already hurt us in intention, and one who is going to do an injury is already doing it. The weakest of men, argues he, are often angry with the most powerful, so you may be sure that anger is not a desire to punish their antagonist, for men do not desire to punish him when they cannot hope to do so. In the first place, I spoke of a desire to inflict punishments, not a power to do so. Now men desire even when they cannot obtain. In the next place, no one is so low in station as not to be able to hope to inflict punishment, even upon the greatest of men. We all are powerful for mischief. Aristotle's definition differs little from mine, for he declares anger to be a desire to repay suffering. It would be a long task to examine the differences between his definition and mine. It may be urged against both of them that wild beasts become angry without being excited by injury, and without any idea of punishing others or requiting them with pain. For, even though they do these things, they are not what they aim at doing. We must admit, however, that neither wild beasts nor any other creature except man is subject to anger. For whilst anger is the foe of reason, it nevertheless does not arise in any place where reason cannot dwell. Wild beasts have impulses, fury, cruelty, combativeness. They have not anger any more than they have luxury. Yet they indulge in some pleasures with less self-control than human beings. Do not believe the poet who says, "The boar his wrath forgets, the stag forgets the hounds, the bear forgets how midst the herd he leapt with frantic bounds." When he speaks of beasts being angry, he means that they are excited, roused up. For indeed, they know no more how to be angry than they know how to pardon. Dumb creatures have not human feelings, but have certain impulses which resemble them. For if it were not so, if they could feel love and hate, they would likewise be capable of friendship and enmity, of disagreement and agreement. Some traces of these qualities exist, even in them, though properly all of them, whether good or bad, belong to the human breast alone. To no creature besides man has been given wisdom, foresight, industry, and reflection. To animals, not only human virtues, but even human vices are forbidden. Their whole constitution, mental and bodily, is unlike that of human beings. In them, the royal and leading principle is drawn from another source, as, for instance, they possess a voice, yet not a clear one, but indistinct and incapable of forming words, a tongue, but one which is fettered and not sufficiently nimble for complex movements. So, too, they possess intellect, the greatest attribute of all, but in a rough and inexact condition. It is, consequently, able to grasp those visions and semblances which rouse it to action, but only in a cloudy and indistinct fashion. It follows from this that their impulses and outbreaks are violent, and that they do not feel fear, anxieties, grief, or anger, but some semblances of these feelings. Wherefore, they quickly drop them and adopt the converse of them. They graze after showing the most vehement rage and terror, and after frantic bellowing and plunging, they straightway sink into quiet sleep. 4. What anger is has been sufficiently explained. The difference between it and irascibility is evident. It is the same as that between a drunken man and a drunkard, between a frightened man and a coward. It is possible for an angry man not to be irascible. An irascible man may sometimes not be angry. I shall admit the other varieties of anger, which the Greeks distinguish by various names, because we have no distinctive words for them in our language, although we call men bitter and harsh, and also peevish, frantic, clamorous, surly, and fierce, all of which are different forms of irascibility. Among these you may class sulkiness, a refined form of irascibility, for there are some sorts of anger which go no further than noise, while some are as lasting as they are common. Some are fierce indeed, but inclined to be sparing of words. Some expend themselves in bitter words and curses. Some do not go beyond complaining and turning one's back. Some are great, deep-seated, and brood within a man. There are a thousand other forms of a multiform evil. 5. We have now finished our inquiry as to what anger is, whether it exists in any other creature besides man, what the difference is between it and irascibility, and how many forms it possesses. Let us now inquire whether anger may be in accordance with nature, and whether it may be useful and worth entertaining in some measure. Whether it be according to nature will become evident if we consider man's nature, than which what is more gentle while it is in its proper condition? Yet what is more cruel than anger? What is more affectionate to others than man? Yet what is more savage against them than anger? Mankind is born for mutual assistance, anger for mutual ruin. The former loves society, the latter estrangement. The one loves to do good, the other to do harm. The one to help even strangers, the other to attack even its dearest friends. The one is ready even to sacrifice itself for the good of others, the other to plunge into peril provided it drags others with it. Who, then, can be more ignorant of nature than he who classes this cruel and hurtful vice as belonging to her best and most polished work? Anger, as we have said, is eager to punish, and that such a desire should exist in man's peaceful breast is least of all according to his nature. For human life is founded on benefits and harmony, and is bound together into an alliance for the common help of all, not by terror, but by love towards one another. 6. What, then? Is not correction sometimes necessary? Of course it is, but with discretion, not with anger. For it does not injure, but heals under the guise of injury. We char crooked spear shafts to straighten them, and force them by driving in wedges, not in order to break them, but to take the bends out of them. And, in like manner, by applying pain to the body or mind, we correct dispositions which have been rendered crooked by vice. So the physician at first, when dealing with slight disorders, tries not to make much change in his patient's daily habits, to regulate his food, drink, and exercise, and to improve his health merely by altering the order in which he takes them. The next step is to see whether an alteration in their amount will be of service. If neither alteration of the order or of the amount is of use, he cuts off some and reduces others. If even this does not answer, he forbids food and disburdens the body by fasting. If milder remedies have proved useless, he opens a vein. If the extremities are injuring the body and infecting it with disease, he lays his hands upon the limbs. Yet none of his treatment is considered harsh if its result is to give health. Similarly, it is the duty of the chief administrator of the laws, or the ruler of a state, to correct ill-disposed men, as long as he is able, with words, and even with gentle ones, that he may persuade them to do what they ought, inspire them with the love of honour and justice, and cause them to hate vice and set store upon virtue. He must then pass on to severer language, still confining himself to advising and reprimanding. Last of all, he must betake himself to punishments, yet still making them slight and temporary. He ought to assign extreme punishments only to extreme crimes, that no one may die unless it be even to the criminal's own advantage that he should die. He will differ from the physician in one point alone, for whereas physicians render it easy to die for those to whom they cannot grant the boon of life, he will drive the condemned out of life with ignominy and disgrace, not because he takes pleasure in any man's being punished, for the wise man is far from such inhuman ferocity, but that they may be a warning to all men, and that, since they would not be useful when alive, the state may at any rate profit by their death. Man's nature is not, therefore, desirous of inflicting punishment. Neither, therefore, is anger in accordance with man's nature, because that is desirous of inflicting punishment. I will also adduce Plato's argument, for what harm is there in using other men's arguments so far as they are on our side? A good man, he says, does not do any hurt. It is only punishment which hurts. Punishment, therefore, does not accord with a good man. Wherefore anger does not do so either, because punishment and anger accord with one another. If a good man takes no pleasure in punishment, he will also take no pleasure in the state of mind to which punishment gives pleasure. Consequently, anger is not natural to man. 7. May it not be that, although anger be not natural, it may be right to adopt it, because it often proves useful? It rouses the spirit and excites it, and courage does nothing grand in war without it, unless its flame be supplied from this source. This is the goad which stirs up bold men and sends them out to encounter perils. Some, therefore, consider it best to control anger, not to banish it utterly, but to cut off its extravagances and force it to keep within useful bounds, so as to retain that part of it without which action will become languid and all strength and activity of mind will die away. In the first place, it is easier to banish dangerous passions than to rule them. It is easier not to admit them than to keep them in order when admitted. For when they have established themselves in possession of the mind, they are more powerful than the lawful ruler, and will in no wise permit themselves to be weakened or abridged. In the next place, reason herself, who holds the reins, is only strong while she remains apart from the passions. If she mixes and befouls herself with them, she becomes no longer able to restrain those whom she might once have cleared out of her path. For the mind, when once excited and shaken up, goes whither the passions drive it. There are certain things whose beginnings lie in our own power, but which, when developed, drag us along by their own force and leave us no retreat. Those who have flung themselves over a precipice have no control over their movements, nor can they stop or slacken their pace when once started, for their own headlong and irremediable rashness has left no room for either reflection or remorse, and they cannot help going to lengths which they might have avoided. So also the mind, when it has abandoned itself to anger, love, or any other passion, is unable to check itself. Its own weight and the downward tendency of vices must needs carry the man off and hurl him into the lowest depth. 8. The best plan is to reject straightway the first incentives to anger, to resist its very beginnings, and to take care not to be betrayed into it. For if once it begins to carry us away, it is hard to get back again into a healthy condition, because reason goes for nothing when once passion has been admitted to the mind, and has by our own free will been given a certain authority. It will, for the future, do as much as it chooses, not only as much as you will allow it. The enemy, I repeat, must be met and driven back at the outermost frontier line, for when he has once entered the city and passed its gates, he will not allow his prisoners to set bounds to his victory. The mind does not stand apart and view its passions from without, so as not to permit them to advance further than they ought, but it is itself changed into a passion, and is therefore unable to check what once was useful and wholesome strength, now that it has become degenerate and misapplied. For passion and reason, as I said before, have not distinct and separate provinces, but consist of the changes of the mind itself, for better or for worse. How then can reason recover itself when it is conquered and held down by vices, when it has given way to anger? Or how can it extricate itself from a confused mixture, the greater part of which consists of the lower qualities? But, argues our adversary, some men, when in anger, control themselves. Do they so far control themselves that they do nothing which anger dictates, or somewhat? If they do nothing thereof, it becomes evident that anger is not essential to the conduct of affairs, although your sect advocated it as possessing greater strength than reason. Finally, I ask, is anger stronger or weaker than reason? If stronger, how can reason impose any check upon it, since it is only the less powerful that obey? If weaker, then reason is competent to effect its ends without anger, and does not need the help of a less powerful quality. But some men remain consistent and control themselves. When do they do so? It is when their anger is disappearing and leaving them of its own accord, not when it was red hot, for then it was more powerful than they. What then? Do not men, even in the height of their anger, sometimes let their enemies go, whole and unhurt, and refrain from injuring them? They do, but when do they do so? It is when one passion overpowers another, and either fear or greed gets the upper hand for a while. On such occasions, it is not thanks to reason that anger is stilled, but owing to an untrustworthy and fleeting truce between the passions. 9. In the next place, anger has nothing useful in itself, and does not rouse up the mind to warlike deeds. For a virtue, being self-sufficient, never needs the assistance of a vice. Whenever it needs an impetuous effort, It does not become angry, but rises to the occasion, and excites or soothes itself as far as it deems requisite. Just as the machines which hurl darts may be twisted to a greater or lesser degree of tension at the manager's pleasure. Anger, says Aristotle, is necessary, nor can any fight be won without it, unless it fills the mind and kindles up the spirit. It must, however, be made use of, not as a general, but as a soldier. Now this is untrue. For if it listens to reason and follows whither reason leads, it is no longer anger, whose characteristic is obstinacy. If, again, it is disobedient and will not be quiet when ordered, but is carried away by its own willful and headstrong spirit, it is then as useless an aid to the mind as a soldier who disregards the sounding of the retreat would be to a general. If, therefore, anger allows limits to be imposed upon it, it must be called by some other name, and ceases to be anger, which I understand to be unbridled and unmanageable. And if it does not allow limits to be imposed upon it, it is harmful and not to be counted among aids. Wherefore, either anger is not anger, or it is useless. For if any man demands the infliction of punishment, not because he is eager for the punishment itself, but because it is right to inflict it, he ought not to be counted as an angry man. That will be the useful soldier, who knows how to obey orders. The passions cannot obey, any more than they can command. 10. For this cause, reason will never call to its aid blind and fierce impulses, over whom she herself possesses no authority, and which she never can restrain, save by setting against them similar and equally powerful passions, as, for example, fear against anger, anger against sloth, greed against timidity. May virtue never come to such a pass, that reason should fly for aid to vices. The mind can find no safe repose there. It must needs be shaken and tempest-tossed, if it be safe only because of its own defects, if it cannot be brave without anger, diligent without greed, quiet without fear. Such is the despotism under which a man must live if he becomes the slave of a passion. Are you not ashamed to put virtues under the patronage of vices? Then, too, reason ceases to have any power if she can do nothing without passion, and begins to be equal and like unto passion. For what difference is there between them if passion without reason be as rash as reason without passion is helpless? They are both on the same level, if one cannot exist without the other. Yet who could endure that passion should be made equal to reason? Then, says our adversary, passion is useful, provided it be moderate. Nay, only if it be useful by nature. But if it be disobedient to authority and reason, all that we gain by its moderation is that the less there is of it, the less harm it does. Wherefore, a moderate passion is nothing but a moderate evil. 11. But, argues he, against our enemies anger is necessary. In no case is it less necessary, since our attacks ought not to be disorderly, but regulated and under control. What, indeed, is it except anger, so ruinous to itself, that overthrows barbarians, who have so much more bodily strength than we, and are so much better able to endure fatigue? Gladiators, too, protect themselves by skill, but expose themselves to wounds when they are angry. Moreover, of what use is anger when the same end can be arrived at by reason? Do you suppose that a hunter is angry with the beasts he kills? Yet he meets them when they attack, and follows them when they flee from him, all of which is managed by reason without anger. when so many thousands of Cimbri and Teutons poured over the Alps, what was it that caused them to perish so completely that no messenger, only common rumour, carried the news of that great defeat to their homes, except that with them anger stood in the place of courage? And anger, although sometimes it overthrows and breaks to pieces whatever it meets, yet is more often its own destruction. Who can be braver than the Germans, who charge more boldly, who have more love of arms, among which they are born and bred, for which alone they care, to the neglect of everything else? Who can be more hardened to undergo every hardship, since a large part of them have no store of clothing for the body, no shelter from the continual rigour of the climate? Yet Spaniards and Gauls, and even the unwarlike races of Asia and Syria, cut them down before the main legion comes within sight, nothing but their own irascibility exposing them to death. Give but intelligence to those minds, and discipline to those bodies of theirs, which now are ignorant of vicious refinements, luxury and wealth. To say nothing more, we should certainly be obliged to go back to the ancient Roman habits of life. By what did Fabius restore the shattered forces of the state, except by knowing how to delay and spin out time, which angry men know not how to do? The empire, which then was at its last gasp, would have perished if Fabius had been as daring as anger urged him to be. But he took thought about the condition of affairs, and after counting his force, no part of which could be lost without everything being lost with it, he laid aside thoughts of grief and revenge, turning his sole attention to what was profitable and to making the most of his opportunities, and conquered his anger before he conquered Hannibal. What did Scipio do? Did not he leave behind Hannibal and the Carthaginian army, and all with whom he had a right to be angry, and carry the war into Africa with such deliberation that he made his enemies think him luxurious and lazy? What did the second Scipio do? Did he not remain a long, long time before Numantia, and bear with calmness the reproach to himself and to his country that Numantia took longer to conquer than Carthage? By blockading and investing his enemies, he brought them to such straits that they perished by their own swords. Anger, therefore, is not useful, even in wars and battles, for it is prone to rashness, and while trying to bring others into danger, does not guard itself against danger. The most trustworthy virtue is that which long and carefully considers itself, controls itself, and slowly and deliberately brings itself to the front. XII. What, then, asks our adversary, is a good man not to be angry if he sees his father murdered or his mother outraged? No, he will not be angry, but will avenge them or protect them. Why do you fear that filial piety will not prove a sufficient spur to him, even without anger? You may as well say, what, then, when a good man sees his father or his son being cut down, I suppose he will not weep or faint, as we see women do, whenever any trifling rumour of danger reaches them. The good man will do his duty without disturbance or fear, and he will perform the duty of a good man, so as to do nothing unworthy of a man. My father will be murdered, then I will defend him. He has been slain, then I will avenge him, not because I am grieved, but because it is my duty. Good men are made angry by injuries done to their friends. When you say this, Theophrastus, you seek to throw discredit upon more manly maxims. You leave the judge and appeal to the mob. Because everyone is angry when such things befall his own friends, you suppose that men will decide that it is their duty to do what they do. For as a rule, every man considers a passion which he recognizes to be a righteous one. But he does the same thing if the hot water is not ready for his drink, if a glass be broken, or his shoe splashed with mud. It is not filial piety, but weakness of mind that produces this anger, as children weep when they lose their parents, just as they do when they lose their toys. To feel anger on behalf of one's friends does not show a loving, but a weak mind. It is admirable and worthy conduct to stand forth as the defender of one's parents, children, friends, and countrymen, at the call of duty itself, acting of one's own free will, forming a deliberate judgment, and looking forward to the future, not in an impulsive, frenzied fashion. No passion is more eager for revenge than anger, and for that very reason it is unapt to obtain it. Being over hasty and frantic, like almost all desires, it hinders itself in the attainment of its own object, and therefore has never been useful either in peace or war. For it makes peace like war, and when in arms forgets that Mars belongs to neither side, and falls into the power of the enemy because it is not in its own. In the next place, vices ought not to be received into common use, because on some occasions they have affected somewhat. For so also fevers are good for certain kinds of ill health, but nevertheless it is better to be altogether free from them. It is a hateful mode of cure to owe one's health to disease. Similarly, although anger, like poison, or falling headlong, or being shipwrecked, may have unexpectedly done good, yet it ought not on that account to be classed as wholesome, for poisons have often proved good for the health. 13. Moreover, qualities which we ought to possess become better and more desirable the more extensive they are. If justice is a good thing, no one will say that it would be better if any part were subtracted from it. If bravery is a good thing, no one would wish it to be in any way curtailed. Consequently, the greater anger is, the better it is, for whoever objected to a good thing being increased. But it is not expedient that anger should be increased. Therefore, it is not expedient that it should exist at all, for that which grows bad by increase cannot be a good thing. Anger is useful, says our adversary, because it makes men more ready to fight. According to that mode of reasoning, then, drunkenness also is a good thing, for it makes men insolent and daring, and many use their weapons better when the worse for liquor. Nay, according to that reasoning also, you may call frenzy and madness essential to strength, because madness often makes men stronger. Why, does not fear, often by the rule of contraries, make men bolder, and does not the terror of death rouse even the arrant cowards to join battle? Yet anger, drunkenness, fear, and the like, are base and temporary incitements to action, and can furnish no arms to virtue, which has no need of vices, although they may at times be of some little assistance to sluggish and cowardly minds. No man becomes braver through anger, except one who, without anger, would not have been brave at all. Anger does not, therefore, come to assist courage, but to take its place. What are we to say to the argument that, if anger were a good thing, it would attach itself to all the best men? Yet the most irascible of creatures are infants, old men, and sick people. Every weakling is naturally prone to complaint. 14. It is impossible, says Theophrastus, for a good man not to be angry with bad men. By this reasoning, the better a man is, the more irascible he will be. Yet will he not rather be more tranquil, more free from passions, and hating no one? Indeed, what reason has he for hating sinners, since it is error that leads them into such crimes? Now, it does not become a sensible man to hate the erring, since if so, he will hate himself. Let him think how many things he does contrary to good morals, how much of what he has done stands in need of pardon, and he will soon become angry with himself also. For no righteous judge pronounces a different judgment in his own case and in that of others. No one, I affirm, will be found who can acquit himself. Everyone who calls himself innocent looks rather to external witnesses than to his own conscience. How much more philanthropic it is to deal with the erring in a gentle and fatherly spirit, and to call them into the right course instead of hunting them down. When a man is wandering about our fields because he has lost his way, it is better to place him on the right path than to drive him away. 15. The sinner ought, therefore, to be corrected both by warning and by force, both by gentle and harsh means, and may be made a better man both towards himself and others by chastisement, but not by anger. For who is angry with a patient whose wounds he is tending? But they cannot be corrected, and there is nothing in them that is gentle or that admits of good hope. Then let them be removed from mortal society, if they are likely to deprave everyone with whom they come in contact, and let them cease to be bad men in the only way in which they can. Yet let this be done without hatred. For what reason have I for hating the man to whom I am doing the greatest good, since I am rescuing him from himself? Does a man hate his own limbs when he cuts them off? That is not an act of anger, but a lamentable method of healing. We knock mad dogs on the head, we slaughter fierce and savage bulls, and we doom scabby sheep to the knife, lest they should infect our flocks. We destroy monstrous births, and we also drown our children, if they are born weakly or unnaturally formed. To separate what is useless from what is sound is an act, not of anger, but of reason. Nothing becomes one who inflicts punishment less than anger, because the punishment has all the more power to work reformation if the sentence be pronounced with deliberate judgment. This is why Socrates said to the slave, "I would strike you, were I not angry." He put off the correction of the slave to a calmer season. At the moment, he corrected himself. Who can boast that he has his passions under control when Socrates did not dare to trust himself to his anger? 16. We do not, therefore, need an angry chastiser to punish the erring and wicked, for since anger is a crime of the mind, it is not right that sin should be punished by sin. What? Am I not to be angry with a robber or a poisoner? No, for I am not angry with myself when I bleed myself. I apply all kinds of punishment as remedies. You are as yet only in the first stage of error, and do not go wrong seriously, although you do so often. Then I will try to amend you by a reprimand, given first in private and then in public. You, again, have gone too far to be restored to virtue by words alone. You must be kept in order by disgrace. For the next, some stronger measure is required. Something that he can feel must be branded upon him. You, sir, shall be sent into exile and to a desert place. The next man's thorough villainy needs harsher remedies. Chains and public imprisonment must be applied to him. You, lastly, have an incurably vicious mind, and add crime to crime. You have come to such a pass that you are not influenced by the arguments which are never wanting to recommend evil, but sin itself is to you a sufficient reason for sinning. You have so steeped your whole heart in wickedness that wickedness cannot be taken from you without bringing your heart with it. Wretched man, you have long sought to die. We will do you good service. We will take away that madness from which you suffer. And to you, who have so long lived a misery to yourself and to others, we will give the only good thing which remains, that is, death. Why should I be angry with a man just when I am doing him good? Sometimes the truest form of compassion is to put a man to death. If I were a skilled and learned physician, and were to enter a hospital or a rich man's house, I should not have prescribed the same treatment for all the patients who were suffering from various diseases. I see different kinds of vice in the vast number of different minds, and am called in to heal the whole body of citizens. Let us seek for the remedies proper for each disease. This man may be cured by his own sense of honour, that one by travel, that one by pain, that one by want, that one by the sword. If, therefore, it becomes my duty as a magistrate to put on black robes and summon an assembly by the sound of a trumpet, I shall walk to the seat of judgment, not in a rage or in a hostile spirit, but with the countenance of a judge. I shall pronounce the formal sentence in a grave and gentle rather than a furious voice, and shall bid them proceed sternly, yet not angrily. Even when I command a criminal to be beheaded, when I sew a parasite up in a sack, when I send a man to be punished by military law, when I fling a traitor or public enemy down the Tarpeian rock, I shall be free from anger, and shall look and feel as though I were crushing snakes and other venomous creatures. Anger is necessary to enable us to punish. What? Do you think that the law is angry with men whom it does not know, whom it has never seen, who it hopes will never exist? We ought, therefore, to adopt the law's frame of mind, which does not become angry, but merely defines offences. For if it is right for a good man to be angry at wicked crimes, it will also be right for him to be moved with envy at the prosperity of wicked men. What, indeed, is more scandalous than that in some cases the very men for whose deserts no fortune could be found bad enough should flourish and actually be the spoiled children of success? Yet he will see their affluence without envy, just as he sees their crimes without anger. A good judge condemns wrongful acts, but does not hate them. What, then, when the wise man is dealing with something of this kind, will his mind not be affected by it and become excited beyond its usual wont? I admit that it will. He will experience a slight and trifling emotion, for, as Zeno says, even in the mind of the wise man a scar remains after the wound is quite healed. He will, therefore, feel certain hints and semblances of passions, but he will be free from the passions themselves. 17. Aristotle says that certain passions, if one makes a proper use of them, act as arms, which would be true if, like weapons of war, they could be taken up or laid aside at the pleasure of their wielder. These arms, which Aristotle assigns to virtue, fight of their own accord, do not wait to be seized by the hand, and possess a man instead of being possessed by him. We have no need of external weapons. Nature has equipped us sufficiently by giving us reason. She has bestowed this weapon upon us, which is strong, imperishable, and obedient to our will, not uncertain or capable of being turned against its master. Reason suffices by itself, not merely to take thought for the future, but to manage our affairs. What, then, can be more foolish than for reason to beg anger for protection, that is, for what is certain to beg what is uncertain, what is trustworthy of what is faithless, what is whole of what is sick? What, indeed? Since reason is far more powerful by itself, even in performing those operations in which the help of anger seems especially needful. For when reason has decided that a particular thing should be done, she perseveres in doing it, not being able to find anything better than herself to exchange with. She, therefore, abides by her purpose when it has once been formed, whereas anger is often overcome by pity, for it possesses no firm strength, but merely swells like an empty bladder, and makes a violent beginning, just like the winds which rise from the earth and are caused by rivers and marshes, which blow furiously without any continuance. Anger begins with a mighty rush, and then falls away, becoming fatigued too soon. That which but lately thought of nothing but cruelty and novel forms of torture is become quite softened and gentle when the time comes for punishment to be inflicted. Passion soon cools, whereas reason is always consistent. Yet even in cases where anger has continued to burn, it often happens that, although there may be many who deserve to die, yet after the death of two or three, it ceases to slay. Its first onset is fierce, just as the teeth of snakes when first roused from their lair are venomous, but become harmless after repeated bites have exhausted their poison. Consequently, those who are equally guilty are not equally punished, and often he who has done less is punished more, because he fell in the way of anger when it was fresher. It is altogether irregular. At one time it runs into undue excess, at another it falls short of its duty. For it indulges its own feelings, and gives sentence according to its own caprices, will not listen to evidence, allows the defence no opportunity of being heard, clings to what it has wrongly assumed, and will not suffer its opinion to be wrested from it, even when it is a mistaken one. 18. Reason gives each side time to plead. Moreover, she herself demands adjournment, that she may have sufficient scope for the discovery of the truth, whereas anger is in a hurry. Reason wishes to give a just decision. Anger wishes its decision to be thought just. Reason looks no further than the matter in hand. Anger is excited by empty matters hovering on the outskirts of the case. It is irritated by anything approaching to a confident demeanour, a loud voice, an unrestrained speech, dainty apparel, high-flown pleading, or popularity with the public. It often condemns a man because it dislikes his patron. It loves and maintains error, even when truth is staring it in the face. It hates to be proved wrong, and thinks it more honourable to persevere in a mistaken line of conduct than to retract it. I remember Gaius Piso, a man who was free from many vices, yet of a perverse disposition, and one who mistook harshness for consistency. In his anger, he ordered a soldier to be led off to execution because he had returned from furlough without his comrade, as though he must have murdered him if he could not show him. When the man asked for time to search, he would not grant it. The condemned man was brought outside the rampart, and was just offering his neck to the axe, when suddenly there appeared his comrade who was thought to be slain. Hereupon the centurion in charge of the execution bade the guardsman sheathe his sword, and led the condemned man back to Piso, to restore him the innocence which fortune had restored to the soldier. They were led into his presence by their fellow soldiers amid the great joy of the whole camp, embracing one another and accompanied by a vast crowd. Piso mounted the tribunal in a fury, and ordered them both to be executed, both him who had not murdered, and him who had not been slain. What could be more unworthy than this? Because one was proved to be innocent, two perished. Piso even added a third, for he actually ordered the centurion, who had brought back the condemned man, to be put to death. Three men were set up to die in the same place, because one was innocent. Oh, how clever is anger at inventing reasons for its frenzy! You, it says, I order to be executed, because you have been condemned to death. You, because you have been the cause of your comrade's condemnation. And you, because when ordered to put him to death, you disobeyed your general. He discovered the means of charging them with three crimes, because he could find no crime in them. He discovered the means of charging them with three crimes, because he could find no crime in them. 19. Irascibility, I say, has this fault. It is loath to be ruled. It is angry with the truth itself if it comes to light against its will. It assails those whom it has marked for its victims with shouting and riotous noise and gesticulation of the entire body, together with reproaches and curses. Not thus does reason act, but if it must be so, she silently and quietly wipes out whole households, destroys entire families of the enemies of the state, together with their wives and children, throws down their very dwellings, levels them with the ground, and roots out the names of those who are the foes of liberty. This she does without grinding her teeth, or shaking her head, or doing anything unbecoming to a judge, whose countenance ought to be especially calm and composed at the time when he is pronouncing an important sentence. "What need is there," asks Hieronymus, "for you to bite your own lips when you want to strike someone?" What would he have said had he seen a proconsul leap down from the tribunal, snatch the fasces from the lictor, and tear his own clothes because those of others were not torn as fast as he wished? Why need you upset the table, throw down the drinking cups, knock yourself against the columns, tear your hair, smite your thigh and your breast? How vehement do you suppose anger to be if it thus turns back upon itself, because it cannot find vent on another as fast as it wishes? Such men, therefore, are held back by the bystanders, and are begged to become reconciled with themselves. But he who, while free from anger, assigns to each man the penalty which he deserves, does none of these things. He often lets a man go after detecting his crime, if his penitence for what he has done gives good hope for the future, if he perceives that the man's wickedness is not deeply rooted in his mind, but is only, as the saying is, skin deep. He will grant impunity in cases where it will hurt neither the receiver nor the giver. In some cases, he will punish great crimes more leniently than lesser ones, if the former were the result of momentary impulse, not of cruelty, while the latter were instinct with secret, underhand, long-practiced craftiness. The same fault committed by two separate men will not be visited by him with the same penalty, if the one was guilty of it through carelessness, the other with a premeditated intention of doing mischief. In all dealing with crime, he will remember that the one form of punishment is meant to make bad men better, and the other to put them out of the way. In either case, he will look to the future, not to the past, for, as Plato says, no wise man punishes anyone because he has sinned, but that he may sin no more. For what is past cannot be recalled, but what is to come may be checked. Those, too, whom he wishes to make examples of the ill success of wickedness, he executes publicly, not merely in order that they themselves may die, but that by dying they may deter others from doing likewise. You see how free from any mental disturbance a man ought to be who has to weigh and consider all this, when he deals with a matter which ought to be handled with the utmost care, I mean the power of life and death. The sword of justice is ill placed in the hands of an angry man. 20. Neither ought it to be believed that anger contributes anything to magnanimity. What it gives is not magnanimity, but vain glory. The increase which disease produces in bodies swollen with morbid humours is not healthy growth, but bloated corpulence. All those whose madness raises them above human considerations believe themselves to be inspired with high and sublime ideas, but there is no solid ground beneath them, and what is built without foundation is liable to collapse in ruin. Anger has no ground to stand upon, and does not rise from a firm and enduring foundation, but is a windy, empty quality, as far removed from true magnanimity as foolhardiness from courage, boastfulness from confidence, gloom from austerity, cruelty from strictness. There is, I say, a great difference between a lofty and a proud mind. Anger brings about nothing grand or beautiful. On the other hand, to be constantly irritated seems to me to be the part of a languid and unhappy mind, conscious of its own feebleness, like folk with diseased bodies covered with sores, who cry out at the lightest touch. Anger, therefore, is a vice which for the most part affects women and children.
Yet it affects men also,
because many men, too, have womanish or childish intellects.
But what are we to say? Do not some words fall from angry men which appear to flow from a great mind?
Yes, to those who know not what true greatness is, as, for example, that foul and hateful saying, "Let them hate me, provided they fear me," which you may be sure was written in Sulla's time. I know not which was the worse of the two things he wished for, that he might be hated or that he might be feared. It occurs to his mind that some day people will curse him, plot against him, crush him. What prayer does he add to this? May all the gods curse him for discovering a cure for hate so worthy of it. Let them hate. How? Provided they obey me? No. Provided they approve of me? No. How then? Provided they fear me. I would not even be loved upon such terms. Do you imagine that this was a very spirited saying? You are wrong. This is not greatness, but monstrosity. You should not believe the words of angry men, whose speech is very loud and menacing, while their mind within them is as timid as possible. Nor need you suppose that the most eloquent of men, Titus Livius, was right in describing somebody as being of a great rather than a good disposition. The things cannot be separated. He must either be good or else he cannot be great, because I take greatness of mind to mean that it is unshaken, sound throughout, firm and uniform to its very foundation, such as cannot exist in evil dispositions. Such dispositions may be terrible, frantic, and destructive, but cannot possess greatness, because greatness rests upon goodness and owes its strength to it.
Yet by speech, action, and all outward show, they will make one think them great.
True, they will say something which you may think shows a great spirit, like Gaius Caesar, who, when angry with the heaven because it interfered with his ballet dancers, whom he imitated more carefully than he attended to them when they acted, and because it frightened his revels by its thunders, surely ill-directed, challenged Jove to a fight, and that to the death, shouting the Homeric verse, "Carry me off, or I will carry thee." How great was his madness! He must have believed either that he could not be hurt even by Jupiter himself, or that he could hurt even Jupiter itself. I imagine that this saying of his had no small weight in nerving the minds of the conspirators for their task, for it seemed to be the height of endurance to bear one who could not bear Jupiter. 21. There is, therefore, nothing great or noble in anger, even when it seems to be powerful and to contemn both gods and men alike. Anyone who thinks that anger produces greatness of mind would think that luxury produces it. Such a man wishes to rest on ivory, to be clothed with purple and roofed with gold, to remove lands, embank seas, hasten the course of rivers, suspend woods in the air. He would think that avarice shows greatness of mind, for the avaricious man broods over heaps of gold and silver, treats whole provinces as merely fields on his estate, and has larger tracts of country under the charge of single bailiffs than those which consuls once drew lots to administer. He would think that lust shows greatness of mind, for the lustful man swims across straits, castrates troops of boys, and puts himself within reach of the swords of injured husbands with complete scorn of death.
Ambition, too, he would think shows greatness of mind. For the ambitious man is not content with office once a year, but, if possible, would fill the calendar of dignities with his name alone, and cover the whole world with his titles. It matters nothing to what heights or lengths these passions may proceed. They are narrow, pitiable, grovelling. Virtue alone is lofty and sublime, nor is anything great which is not at the same time tranquil.